go to sleep, motherfucker. Don't go to sleep.
And do me a favor. Don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired.
Well, what the hell are you saying, Doss? You bruised half your body sleeping.
I sleep pretty hard.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Hey, it's Brian.
And hey, it's Murdoch. Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
You get involved in the show by sending us an email. It's wearethestoryguys@gmail.com, like Nando from New Bedford. Here is the letter from him. What's up, guys? Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories is my favorite podcast to listen to.
Yes.
I love when I receive an alert on a new episode.
Yes.
That makes me happy, man. Thank
yes.
you.
Yes.
What do you know about the story where David Bowie punched Axl Rose on the Sunset Strip?
Yes! What a freaking letter!
Did that really happen? That's what he wants to know.
By the way, tuning in for the first time, this is what the show
this
is.
This is what it's all about. Welcome.
Did David Bowie punch Axl in the face? And we talk about these guys on the show. We've talked about the, you know, Guns N' Roses for
sure. I think like all together, maybe 10 episodes already that involve one or both of these characters, Axl or David Bowie.
But here we're talking about Bowie's sex appeal, really.
He
kinda
is a sexy guy. And I love this idea where he's like sex incarnate. Like, if you read much about Bowie, you're very quickly going to find just story after story about people that he's been in bed with, supposedly. Maybe, maybe not. But, I mean, that's everybody from Aaron Everly, who, spoiler alert, we're going to talk about in a moment, to Iggy, to Jagger. All of these people.
Yeah. And we'll talk about Aaron canoodling with Axl. That's going to happen. And by the way, Jagger calls Bowie at one point the devil from Bromley because he stole people's girlfriends.
Right. And that's one of those things that floats around quite a bit about him. And I hear it mentioned at random, but I think the main core text for that comes from this story, and we're going to get there.
Yeah. And David Bowie had lots of sex and had sex with everybody and had orgies and all kinds of stuff.
Crazy stuff when I started doing the research about, like, quotes from Angie about walking into these orgies and all sorts of stuff. But I saw a list of names. Here's just a few of the names that were supposed sexual partners of David Bowie at some point. Tina Turner, Ronnie Spector, Susan Sarandon? Did you know that?
Yeah, there's this movie called The Hunger. It's a Tony Scott movie.
Is that a vampire movie?
Kind of. It sucks. I mean, it's not my fit. Yeah, I mean, kind of. But you do know.
I think it's very much a vampire movie, isn't it?
Yeah. I, when we were looking at this, like, I had to go and like look it up, and I like watched the trailer, and I was like, yeah, I think I watched that. But I mean, it's 83. Good gosh.
I know. You know, the year I was born.
It's not Labyrinth or anything like that. But look, as far as Tina Turner, I know this for sure. I mean, it has to be. I always heard she said it never happened. And he was just a really big help on her career. And really, people love Tina. They loved her, and a lot of people helped her out because they always respected her as a performer.
Right.
They
right.
thought that Ike fucked up her career or whatever. So David was one of those people. And apparently came out of a backstage shower stark naked once with one of her wigs, which to me is how you say hi. What's going on?
This is a quintessential Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories episode.
We've already got
nudity, really are.
Yeah. Sex.
So much sex.
Everything.
We're like 3 minutes in, and it's just dripping. Okay. So I want to stay focused on the incident that we're here to talk about.
Yeah.
But it's hard to talk about Bowie at all, especially for the story that we're headed to, without talking about this aspect of him.
Yeah. Yeah. But let's talk about this Jagger thing for a minute.
Right.
So there was always this rumor about Jagger and Bowie being lovers, that had happened, or possibly, you know, together in a threesome with other people. It's definitely the rumor that seems to be widely accepted. And we're so going to talk about that music video in a minute. I know that's what you're thinking. But these two guys spent a lot of portions of their career trying to be like each other.
Well, okay, so I was thinking about this.
As does Jagger, like Tina Turner, because remember he took Tina and Ike out and
we did a whole episode on Jagger aping Tina, but they also, Bowie and Jagger, ape each other. Aladdin Sane is kind of his Stones record.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, doesn't he cover the Stones on Aladdin Sane?
Yeah, right?
Yeah. And the there's this idea a little bit that Jagger is envious of Bowie because Bowie can basically do whatever he wants. Like, Jagger very quickly gets in this lane, and for his entire career and his entire life, he's been Mick Jagger. But Mick Jagger doesn't really get out of this, like, swagger thing.
He's in a band, too.
Yeah.
He's not a solo artist.
Right.
At the time, he does solo records later.
But Bowie is characters and different genres, and he acts. He does all this stuff, right? So there's always been this, like, there's this little bit of like sort of competition slash envy between the two of them.
But it's like there's multiple versions of Bowie, but there's a singular version
of
Jagger based on just what he has to do.
Right.
And then to be meta in the most 80s way possible, yes, everyone. They parody their own relationship by covering Dancing in the Streets in 85 as a fundraising single that debuts during Live Aid, and it's a huge hit. For God's sakes, go on YouTube and watch this stupid video, this stupid song, and then watch the versions where there's no music.
So tell me about these other versions.
There's people have taken the music off, so it's just the vocals, and then and then they've taken all of it out, and they, what do you call it when they take everything out and they just add that, like, funny noises or whatever? Uh-huh. Where it,
yeah, it's quite the artifact. I had never really thought about the meta component of it. That they were almost,
yeah, me neither.
They were almost like poking fun at themselves by doing it.
I just thought they were together, and that's what I didn't know. But so we talked. So lots of acting for Bowie, right? So we mentioned the Vampire movie in 83 and 86. You get Absolute Beginners, and then Labyrinth, for Pete's sake. By the way, I saw that in the big screen. Still good. After all those big pop albums in the 80s, he gets interested in rocking a little harder. He tours during that period. He takes Frampton out as a guitar player, and then he meets this guy that's now in The Cure, Reeves. How do you say Reeves' last name?
Gabriels.
So
he's in The Cure now. Way back in the mid-80s, he's married to this woman who is doing publicity for Bowie,
and Bowie himself is in a weird position in this period. So he's always been a guy who had been known and accepted as a visionary, but in the early 80s, his audience does expand. He's on pop radio, and it's very strategic, specifically with Let's Dance and with how that record was
that
put together.
Makes him a pop star.
Yeah.
And a much wider audience now. So he starts to feel weird about this, because now he feels like he has this responsibility to this larger group of people. And so the next two records, famously, are ones people don't talk about, that are panned when they come out and have not held up to most scrutiny. And he feels like he has to please the mass market. I saw a quote where he refers to this period. David Bowie refers to this period as his, quote, Phil Collins period.
Which is interesting, because if you think about the 80s, like, there was no escaping Phil Collins, because he was on MTV in every single place possible.
And that's actually what I think he means. I don't think that's a dig at Collins.
Yeah. And if you do think about, like, here, let's talk our age gap a bit, too. When I was 10, I heard this song on the radio that I loved, and I don't know who schooled me and told me that Major Tom by Tom Schilling was a cover song. I had never listened to that. But so for people like me or Gen Xers with MTV who didn't get Bowie in the 70s, because listen to Kenny Rogers, like MTV introduced me to David Bowie. And like all of David Bowie, because he was on MTV. He did interviews. Like, he was, you got to see and hear what he was talking about. You knew he was a influential person.
Well, and on that record, so on the Let's Dance record, we also have China Girl. Can we talk about China Girl for a second?
I love to play that song, man. It's so good.
How many people do you think know that that's an Iggy Pop song first?
It can't be. And it's so, and Iggy's version, by the way, I think so much better. But yeah, it's an Iggy, it's a...
Well, they write it together, let's be clear. Yeah. If you're just now learning this, they write it together, but Iggy records it in the late 70s. And the rumor is that Bowie basically put it on this record as a favor to get Iggy paid because he needed money.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know that's 100% true. And it got the Niles Rogers treatment, so it's a lot slicker. So if you haven't heard China Girl by Iggy Pop, do it. It and you'll be like, oh, I like this.
Yeah, it's
one
got
better
this
than-
kind of, it's got this drone to it.
China Girl,
and it's also the it's guitar song. And like,
do you know what this is about?
Yeah,
supposedly
yeah.
Iggy had an affair with a woman with whom he did not share a first language.
That's correct. Yeah, and also it said that Iggy made up the lyrics in the studio. And that's during the idiot.
Do you think that's true?
Have you ever seen Iggy when he's like cracked out on coke or heroin on
his TV
interviews?
I love the idea that they had it like, so Bowie's going to cover this. He has to go back and get the lyrics. And these made up lyrics have to be learned by someone else.
Do you remember Larry Miller, our old coworker used to work with?
Yeah.
I went to Larry's house one time and to watch DVDs. And the first one he put on was the Iggy concert in Cincinnati, where he cut himself and then put peanut butter all over his chest. And I thought, dude, Larry's like 30 years older than me, but dude, Larry's all right. What the fuck are we watching this for? So weird.
When a dude 30 years older than you invites you over to watch Iggy Pop rub peanut butter on himself.
I'm like, I don't know, man. Guy seems a lot cooler than I thought.
I'm into this. Yeah. So Bowie wants to make China Girl the first single on Let's Dance, but Nile Rodgers convinces him to go to the title track instead. Another fun fact, Let's Dance released as a single on the day I was born.
Totally weird. March 14th.
Isn't that funny? March 14th, 1983.
Yeah. Also, who does a great cover of Let's Dance is Ween.
Also, M. Ward. You ever heard the M Ward cover?
Yeah, I have. Brilliant. There's a Ween version when Gene is really in bad shape and looks like he weighs 130 pounds, but he sounds like David Bowie. It's like one of those things where it's like, the smack's great. But anyway, you can find that on YouTube. He's in Bend, Oregon, Ween, China, like Let's Dance. Anyway, huge hit. It puts Bowie into a period of his career that is not even thought of like now. So at the end of the 80s roll around, he gets interested in rocking harder. He meets this guy we mentioned earlier.
This is Reeves Gabriels now. We're back to this guy, this guitar player. And this is him talking. I met David during the Glass Spider tour. My ex-wife Sarah was doing press, so I hung around backstage a lot and talked to him. He didn't know I played guitar, and I never told him. He just thought that I knew a lot about music and art. But Sarah gave him a tape of my band, and he listened to it. So one day I'm at home, and he calls me. I thought it was a practical joke, and I said, all right, who the fuck is this?
So good. This is continuing to quote. He said, it's David. Sarah gave me the tape, and you sound like the guy I've been looking for. Why didn't you tell me you play guitar? So I flew to Switzerland and went right in the studio with him. Man, I wish that would happen to someone I knew.
Why don't you tell me you play guitar? I'm David Bowie.
And while they work on some one-off stuff together, what they end up doing as part of this like 10-year musical partnership that they form is creating a band called Tin Machine. T-I-N Machine. Were you into Tin Machine?
I saw them twice.
You saw them live?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I saw Tin Machine twice. And
I didn't even know there was a possibility you could have seen them more than once.
Yeah. And I mean, one of it was a showcase. And it was like a CMJ showcase. And another time
that's College Music Journal for those of you at home.
Oh, I'm such an idiot.
Let me do some acronyms for all you people that don't understand the acronyms.
But okay, so they were promoting themselves to college radio in the early 90s. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because that was weird to me that happened. And then I can't remember where else.
Meet Bowie.
Nah. Okay. And the most embarrassing thing, I want to tell everybody the most embarrassing things about yourself. I saw Bowie Nine Inch Nails. No idea.
What do you mean?
Blank.
Oh, no, like you don't remember. Imbibed?
I don't remember anything about that show.
You just know you were there.
Mm-hmm. I miss David Bowie and Nine Inch Nails. And they might have sang Hurt together, sang some songs together. They did stuff.
What year was this?
This is in the 90s. Post Woodstock 94, I guess.
Okay, so smack in the middle.
Yeah, and Bowie and him had interesting conversations where Bowie came to him and was like, nah, man, you stopped it. You got to stop what you're doing, man.
In terms of like drugs and stuff?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, and Trent has said that. Like
So it's interesting. I mean, that is jumping ahead, but eventually Bowie will go on tour with a band like Nine Inch Nails. But at this period, he wants to prove himself to the rock scene. This band, Tin Machine, if you are not familiar with them, is a quote-unquote hard rock band.
They're a rock band.
I will say, doesn't really sound like hard rock in 2024. It sounds just like slightly amped up Bowie songs.
Yeah.
But he starts it with Reeves, and he says he's inspired in part because he's been listening to this band called the Pixies. So imagine David Bowie listening to the Pixies, trying to start a rock band to distance himself from top 40 radio.
Yeah, and Bowie's very worried about this becoming anything but an enjoyable musical experience, and he wants it to be a true band and partnership. So he does the crazy stuff. They split the money.
Yeah.
The press and interviews, they split it. You don't have like a one
You might
person.
Not get Bowie.
You
might have to talk to Reeves.
It's really interesting if you can catch him in this part of his career because it's an interesting time for him.
Yeah, and they do this for a few years. Apparently, because you saw him twice.
I guess.
At least once for sure.
A couple of albums, and then they're done. But I bring this up because it's important background to know before entering the rest of this story that at this point in his life, Bowie is very interested in being a rock and roll guy. And I know that we think of him as a rock and roll guy now, in 2024, because of what he did in the 70s. We're like, oh, he's a rock star. And he really taught us a lot about rock stardom along with Jagger, right?
Yeah.
But musically, he was a pop star in the 80s.
Enter stage right, W. Axl Rose. So this is Bowie encounters Axl at the same general period in which he's personally reckoning with what means to be in a band. And yeah, what it means to have a true partnership and to play heavier music.
And so to amp this whole story up even more, for the Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories of it all, it supposedly happens during the creation of a legendary GNR artifact.
Yeah, it's the video that really never really got to be anywhere for anybody. It's the video for It's So Easy.
And now I'm going to quit talking, and I'm going to let you take over. Because we're to the GNR portion of the show, so I'm going to drink a beer.
For the early part of their career, It's So Easy was the opening song for everything. Yeah. It was a West Arkeen song. And so for non-GNR heads, West was Duff's neighbor. West taught Duff how to play alternate tunings. The two of them wrote quite a few songs together that would end up being GNR songs. And he was close with most of the band. Axl once said that he could be the third guitar player at one point, which is wacky.
I heard that supposedly this original version of this song that West and Duff write together is like almost a country song. And I guess I can kind of hear that. Like, if you turn it on and think of a stripped-down version of it, I could hear how that would lend itself to that.
Have you heard the slow version of You're Crazy?
Mm-mm.
You don't want my love. You want satisfaction. You're fucking crazy.
I mean,
listen, so you just slow down the tempo.
Slow it down enough, and anything would be a country.
And all there, and it's like... Dun, 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 dun. Anyway, most of the songs on Appetite are tunes that each of the guys brought with them into the band. Some of them are from Hollywood Rose.
Yeah, right.
Some of them are just from things that they had written with the neighbor. And they get the full band treatment when they take them together. And they make it unique to the band when you have Izzy slash playing guitar. Right.
And they and add their own parts and stuff. So it becomes very collaborative. But there's pieces of these songs that exist beforehand. So there's this weird timeline issue that we need to point out that leads to
the larger story.
So Appetite is released in July of 87. Our Bowie and Axl encounter takes place in October of 89, but at a video shoot for a song off of Appetite. So why are they shooting a video for this 2 years later?
Yeah, it's a great story about that record and about Guns N' Roses. That album, which is considered... I will disagree, maybe. One of the greatest rock records of all time was essentially a failure, totally true at first. It takes the president of Geffen Records fighting with MTV, where he was like, play Welcome to the Jungle at night.
Yeah.
And broke the record eventually.
One of the interesting things I read about this argued that all of this centered around a couple of things. A, the rock competition at the time. Because you had Aerosmith's return, you had Def Leppard's Hysteria, and B, MTV was positioning to be rock and roll at the time was very, very different.
Yeah.
So I pulled the list of the top five videos on MTV for the year of 87. Read that list.
Yeah. Hey, before I read it, Aerosmith and their return getting five buses with their five AA guys
right
on there. They asked Guns N' Roses to open up for them, and while Guns N' Roses was opening up for Aerosmith, Guns N' Roses ended up having the number one record in the country, and that happened. And what a bummer to have that band break when you're trying to, because they were real. I mean, they did. They hired outside songwriters. That's what Aerosmith finally did, and it worked, obviously. So here's the top five videos of 87. And I can't wait to say this part if I haven't said this on the podcast. Number one on here is U2's With or Without You, which the Rod Stewart impersonator in Cypress said when I came back to the bathroom from the bathroom, there always has to be one shit song in a set. Bon Jovi's Living on a Prayer. Land of Confusion by Genesis. There it is. Big Time by Peter Gabriel. There's the other one.
See, this is what I mean.
And then the other guy that was in originally in Genesis, David Coverdale. I'm just kidding. He was in Deep Purple. White Snakes, Here I Go Again with Tawny Kitaen and the Jaguar.
If there are two opposite poles of rock in the 80s, here they are.
Yeah.
U2 and Guns N' Roses. So you can imagine trying to position anything on Appetite right after playing With or Without You is a little difficult. Additionally... Yeah. While you do see two bands here that stick out as being maybe rock bands or even hair bands, Whitesnake and Bon Jovi, Whitesnake is old school, right? Dressed as new school, because you pointed out Coverdale was in Deep Purple.
And Whitesnake's an old band.
Yeah.
They got freshened up quite a bit.
So that doesn't really bother the establishment because that's classic rock, basically, even at that point. And Bon Jovi always seemed like they were playing dress up, right? Like that was never dangerous. But GNR was dangerous because they were actually doing the things they were singing about. You often hear us talk about Patreon, but a lot of times people don't know what they're going to get for their money. So I thought I'd show you. And here's a little snippet of a Patreon-only conversation.
Before I tell the story we're going to tell, I'm going to tell an embarrassing story.
Oh, you got one better than that?
Yeah, one where you're glad that people didn't take photographs.
Oh, okay.
There wasn't Facebook. There was this party at my apartment. And, yeah. So anyway, things...
You've got the look. You've got that look in your eye of like an old man talking about the war. Yeah.
So bet all kind.
There's this party.
If you want to hear the rest of that, it's really easy to head to patreon.com and sign up for $5 or $10 a month to support the show. What do we do with the money? We're saving it until we have enough to buy a kangaroo. But your contribution can help us get there quicker, faster, rather than slower and later. So patreon.com/rockandrollbedtimestories. Support the show.
I had this bootleg from my girlfriend in Canada. Right, I like always saying that. So when I was a kid, I got this bootleg where Guns N' Roses is on tour with Cinderella. Okay. And Steven Adler is out for some reason. So Fred Curry, the drummer from Cinderella, is playing for both bands. So I've got this cassette, and I'm there because I hear at the beginning of it is Back in Black. So that's the Vamp song that's happening right before Guns N' Roses comes on. So instead of like It's So Easy coming on, it's Axl. And he goes, "I want to dedicate this performance to the police last night in Chicago." And he goes in this freaking rant about the police and what buttholes they were the night before. And it's like, it goes on for so many minutes, and then he somehow works in, you know, "Yeah, but it's so easy." Like he works into the intro, but it's like so petty and ridiculous, and we're gonna fight. But that whole thing made them sound dangerous. It's like you were fighting with the cops last night. Where's your drummer at?
Right.
Yeah. So they worked their asses off, and they toured, and that's how that.
And they do break. Yeah, I mean, obviously they become huge, but a large part of that is because they go really hard on the road. They tour. And It's So Easy becomes a big part of that because they're opening with it most nights.
Yeah.
And so it's this staple of the Guns N' Roses live show. And they even include it on Use Your Illusion, right? Like they do it for a long time as the opening. So they want to show off that they are like kind of what the live show is like. So they decide that in October of 89, they will film performances of this song, and they will make a performance clip promo video of It's So Easy, even though it's 2 years old, because it is the song that tells the story of how crazy and wild and dangerous the live show is.
But the video is not just a performance video. Ultimately, there's some problems with the non-performance part. So let's get into the third person we'd like to have in this story. That is Aaron Everly.
Oh, Aaron Everly. Fun thing I found in the research, an auction link from a decade plus ago in which the breakup letters written by Axl to Aaron were sold for $5,000.
Yeah, that came from her. Aaron Everly.
Really?
Yes. Aaron Everly sold. Yeah, I actually know this is terrible. I mean, how did her dad and her uncle like not? How did they not give her any money? So she put these things up for auction 2013, along with her marriage certificate and photos of Axl as a kid.
Just like stuff he left in her apartment?
Yeah, I mean,
it's messed up, man.
Why do you need that money? So Erin, of course, is the daughter of Don Everly from the Everly Brothers, who might be the Everly brother that asked my mom out on a date. That she said no to because she thought he was weird because he painted his bedroom black. I don't know if it's Don, but I think it is Don. Just think, if she had went out with Don...
Aaron Everly could be your sister.
Or I would have never existed. It'd have been like that other sliding door thing where it's like fucking didn't make it.
What if what happened was Aaron Everly never existed and thus... Guns N' Roses never existed, like ripped a hole in the musical universe because of you, we have Guns N' Roses.
What if I just what if none of that, all that happened, and then I'm born somehow and I'm Guns N' Roses? Maybe that's what happened. Anyway, so there is an Everly brother that asked my mom out, and it is a true statement.
Oh my God. Infamously, the Everlys are known for fighting with each other all the time.
But hey, he dodged that one.
and there's a crazy Everly story, or Everly brothers breakup story too, right? I only point this out because there's probably some Freudian psychology to link father and lover together in Aaron's life here.
Jeez. They'll eventually get married. They annul it like after a year. And this relationship is very famous just for being rocky.
Oh, yeah. I listened to this quote. this is Axel. Aaron and I treated each other like crap. Sometimes we treated each other great because the children and us were best friends. But there were other times when we just messed up each other's lives completely. And so in the mid-90s, after Stephanie Seymour sues Axel, Aaron also will allege abuse. And so it gets pretty ugly between all of them. And they're together early, though. Like, this is before the GNR success. And most people probably know this, but Sweet Child of Mine is about her.
Yeah, yeah. And this is the first video Aaron is in. She's in that video. And that one's a lot less racy than the one we are discussing now. It's So Easy.
And so to explain this, I found a quote from GNR manager Alan Niven.
Go, Alan.
Quote, Axel wanted to put in some S&M stuff. I mean, as you do. Again, back to this thing. Guns N' Roses, dangerous, right? We don't just sing about it. We do it. We're not Bon Jovi with the Aquanet. We are out here, you know, whipping our girlfriends. Like, they're, this is, I mean, that's literally what's happening.
That's literally what's happening.
Okay, Axel wanted to put in some S&M stuff that he shot with Aaron Everly. Unbeknownst to me at the time, he quietly arranged it with Nigel Dick, who was the director of the video. When I went to look at the footage and sit with Nigel and start to do a basic edit on it, there was a lot of Aaron hanging off the door, putting in a ball gag, her being beaten, and stuff like that.
Yeah. So ultimately, this doesn't get on MTV. And
what?
And why it is a legendary lost artifact, it actually doesn't get really in front of anybody until 2018.
So you just hear about it.
Yeah.
This is the ultimate Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories artifact, right? For years. And they do finally put it out. You can go find it on YouTube now. It is in the show notes. Now, let's settle into the actual day where this potential fight between Axel and David happens. So, it's the video shoot, but where is the video shoot happening?
Yeah, it's happening at the Cat House. That's in Hollywood. It's owned by Tammy Down of Faster Pussycat and Ricky Rackman, who we thought about, like, last year, like, do we try to get Ricky Rackman?
We almost hung out with Ricky Rackman. Yeah.
So, and I wanted to hang out with him because I'm Star Trek struck. No matter like if that guy like works at like a Dollar Tree at this point, Ricky Rackman was hosting Headbanger's Ball, for God's sake.
So this is
he might as well have been hosting The Tonight Show for me.
I was going to ask you. Like, I know this was an important thing for you.
Yeah. When Adam Curry was hosting Headbanger's Ball, I was like, yeah, that's just a guy with a lot of Aquanet and is not a metal guy.
Well,
but Ricky Rackman owns the Cat House.
Here's the interesting thing, though. There is a connection between Ricky and Axel. Axel gets Ricky that job.
That's correct. Yeah.
He flies him to New York.
Yeah.
Like, on his own dime.
Yeah.
And basically tells the people at MTV, this is the guy you need to put on that that rock and roll video show that you're doing. And here's the thing about the Cat House. It's not really a live music venue. It's like a bar. They can fit like 700 people in there, so Ricky would occasionally let people perform there, but he didn't like promote shows. That wasn't really what it was about.
No. As for the day in question, though, like what we're talking about, GNR has an invite to open for the Stones in LA, which, by the way, in the middle of that show, that's the show where Axel says, this is the last Guns N' Roses show.
Yeah. Oh,
because
yeah.
People in this band are dancing with Mr. Brownstone. What a hilarious thing to say out loud in any place. So they reach out to Ricky and ask to play the Cat House to get ready
for
the
Stones.
Yeah,
they want to do warm-up shows at the Cat House.
So since they're going to be there, he's like, hey, the afternoon before the show, we can film a music video. Of course, that sounds a great idea.
Yeah, this doesn't seem like... This seems like a lot of pressure to put on one day. You're gonna film a video and you're gonna do a show. I don't feel like that would be advised.
Yeah,
but
read this next sentence because it's so good.
That is what they do. And so Aaron Everly is on site for this shoot in leather bondage gear, and in walks a drunk David Bowie.
I love this sentence. Everything that Brian just said is all the things that are about this podcast that I love, and I wish that if I could do things, if I could just be in the cat house where Aaron Everly comes up and she has a leather bondage suit and David Bowie walks in and he's hammered. I don't know. Top 10 things, places to be. If I had a time machine.
That's the time machine trip.
But like,
that's the DeLorean Express.
I'll get to Baby Hitler and kill that prick. But first, I want to get to the cat house and see drunk David Bowie punch him in the face. So now we have this breakdown of how this story is told.
There are kind of three accounts of this story that get tossed around and combined into what you will hear and read on the internet. Axel does an interview or two in the years following where he will talk about it a little bit. Slash will bring it up in his memoir. And Ricky, he'll actually talk about it to Kerrang at some point.
Yeah. And it's usually told out of order. You'll hear that Axel was insulting Bowie from the stage at the performance, and Bowie leaves the show because he feels harassed.
And then, like, no one understands why Bowie is leaving the show. And it is then revealed that Bowie had been at the actual video shoot earlier in the day. The story goes, he walks in there drunk. Aaron Everly is in this leather bondage gear, and he's making passes at her.
Oh.
And so that is why Axel is irritated with him. Now, I'm positive we've talked about this on the show at least once before. But remember how we mentioned that David Bowie had sex with everybody?
Yeah, we talked about that earlier.
One of the people he had sex with,
yes,
was Slash's mom.
That is right.
In the 70s, she was his costume designer.
That is correct. So that is the connecting thread to why Bowie was at the performance. But it doesn't quite explain why Bowie was at the video shoot.
And it gets muddy as to when this confrontation actually takes place during this day. This is from a 2015 interview with Ricky talking about his memories of the cat house. And this is like one of the canonical versions of this story. And he doesn't really tell the story. If you listen to it, he just kind of like says a couple sentences, but read that.
Yeah. My best memories are the stories about what happens when you don't know how to deal with running a club. It was basically the home away from home for Guns N' Roses. They knew they could do whatever they wanted in that club. Now, when your security guard comes up to you and says, "Ricky, Axl Rose is chasing David Bowie down the street saying he's going to kill him. What should I do?" Well, how do you answer something like that? You've got one of your better friends chasing one of your idols down the street.
Now, when is he chasing Bowie down the street?
Is that a real story?
This is what I can't figure out. Yeah. Is it during the video shoot? Is it after Bowie leaves the performance? Does he then leave the stage and chase him? It's all very unclear and confusing and makes me wonder if it actually happened in the way that it's told. But the story comes with this amazing line that will explain why we spent 5 to 10 minutes talking about the band Tin Man.
The Tin Machine.
Tin Machine, right. Yeah.
Ricky apparently says, this is why I wanted to meet him now. God. Ricky says that Axel was running yelling, "I'm going to kill you, Tin Man." Which doesn't sound real.
That doesn't sound real either. Nothing. But it's an amazing line.
Yeah.
But hilarious. Now, how about punching? This is actually what we get asked. Did
he punch him?
Did David Bowie punch Axel Rose?
Yeah. So there's a fairly infamous photo that you can find in the show notes that looks like it was taken right after Axel got punched by someone for something.
But verifying exactly where this photo is from is very challenging. Across the internet, you will see it dated from anywhere from 1985 to 1989. Some claim that it was taken by Vicki Hamilton, who was their manager at the time, or her husband, who was around. And the other thing is people say that it was a direct result of this incident. But if you just Google Axl Rose punched, this is a fun thing to do if you're bored tonight. Google that phrase. There are lots of stories involving lots of people from throughout lots of different time periods punching or being punched by Axl Rose. There's a lot of that.
Do you remember the video I sent you where I can't believe someone has it, where we've talked about it on the show, where it's the Axl Kurt Cobain thing and it's Kurt on stage telling the story?
Yeah, yeah. You said this to me in the last 2 weeks. Welcome to our lives.
Yeah, yeah. Where Kurt says, "Axel said, you better tell that bitch to shut up." And Kurt said he turned to Courtney and he said, "Shut up, bitch." Like, yeah, he tells yeah. that story well, just like that.
And we've covered that on the show.
It's so
one of the
crazy.
Probably 10 episodes about Axl Rose or David Bowie that we've done is the one about Guns N' Roses versus Nirvana.
Yeah.
And how all that went down backstage at MTV. And this has some similar vibes to that story of Axl being getting pissed off and worked up and yelling dumb things.
But back to the photo. The shirt that he is wearing in that photo doesn't seem to be anywhere present in the video, right?
No.
So that isn't conclusive proof. It doesn't leave room to say whether this could be from a different time. You don't really know.
You don't know. And, I mean, if he... This is the time period as to when the punch happened, whether it was in the afternoon or in the evening. Why that's a big question mark is like, okay, if they were rehearsing for the show and he wasn't in his video clothes, would there have been time before that? What did he wear on stage that night? It doesn't look like something he would have worn on stage. So it's all very confusing. There seems to be no actual confirmation from the bands on whether or not punches were even thrown. If you really read around these stories, that's actually kind of skirted. Most of what you hear is that they were insulting each other and maybe that they were pursuing each other. But they, in their official accounts, don't really say much about actually punching. There's very little citation for that. We just know they were pissed off. And the story changes from it being Axl throwing a punch at Bowie to Bowie's bodyguards landing a punch on Axl.
Right. So the actual answer to the letter we got today that started this all off is maybe.
Regardless of what happened on the actual night in question, there is a great addendum to this story. And this is where we get back to the devil of Bromley. And Axl tells this story in interviews years after this all goes down.
So the exact timeline, again, is unclear. But Axl says that Mick Jagger will ask him about the situation with Bowie, which is so interesting. Now we've got Jagger and Axl together because of them.
Well, and this story gets told, to your point, like they are backstage the next night. Like, I don't really know, again, if the timeline breaks down like that.
Yeah.
But they basically make it sound like, okay, this happened, and then they go to do those shows for the Stones in the next few days, and he gets cornered backstage.
So that timeline, not really sure. Like, we don't really know. But here's the quote from Axl. Mick Jagger and Eric Clapton cornered me. How crazy is that?
This is a great just mental image.
I'm sitting on this amp and all of a sudden they're both right there in front of me, and Jagger doesn't really talk a lot, and all of a sudden he's like, "So you got in a fight with Bowie, did you?" So I told him the story real quick, and him and Clapton are going off about Bowie and their own little world, talking about things from years ago. They were saying things like, when Bowie gets drunk, he turns into the devil from Bromley.
Oh my God.
I mean, I'm not even in this conversation. I'm just sitting there listening to him bitch like crazy about Bowie, and it was funny.
The other talking point that gets added to this story by Axl is the tale that Bowie actually will apologize to him for this incident. But I don't know if I believe that happened either.
No.
So what do you, if you had to say, here is what I think happened, what would be your response?
I think one of them punched the other in the face, and I think...
You think there were punches thrown?
Maybe, yeah. And I don't think that Axl probably would hit David Bowie. I don't think that would be a thing that he would do. I'm having trouble imagining that David Bowie gets drunk and, other than just wanting to sleep with everybody, wants to punch anybody. It's a weird thing to kind of, because I don't ever think about him at all.
Or David Bowie's bodyguards. That seems
that's
maybe true.
Yeah.
Though they're not really mentioned in the rest of the story. It's just all of a sudden their bodyguards appear when Axl gets out of sorts. I kind of think this story gets totally bandied about because it's a great thing to talk about in interviews for all of the parties involved.
Yeah, it is.
I think it's gotten embellished. I think that maybe what happens is Bowie comes in, he says something to Aaron Everly, Axl Rose is like, dude, lay off. And then he's rude to him that night and he leaves the show. And
it could be nothing.
It could be nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, they've all kind of agreed clearly to carry this story on, but I'm a little skeptical. I just don't think, and I will say I'm skeptical because doing the research, there's not enough of a conclusive, definitive account. All of the accounts are like summaries that don't have real details, and they all vary a little bit.
Yeah.
If you've got a letter, if you've got a question, send it to us. wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. You can find us on YouTube. Watch the show there. Patreon.com/rockandrollbedtimestories if you want to support it. Instagram.com/rockandrollbedtimestories if you want stuff in your feed during the week.
Yep.
And until next time, Murdoch, what should people keep doing?
Keep punching Axl Rose in the face and keep telling stories!
Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories is a Story Guys production. The show is produced and edited by Brian Eichenberger. Get more stories, hear more podcasts, and book the guys for your conference or house party at wearethestoryguys.com. Copyright Boy Have We Got Stories Productions. All rights reserved.